And Gordon, the floor is yours.
You're not going to read my bio?
Okay.
Thank you very much for having me, Dan and Harley, and welcome to all of you who are on here. Gordon Ressler at DARPA's Tactical Technology Office, and I'll be talking about our new program, Robotic Servicing of Geosynchronous Satellites. So a quick history of recent events. We put out a press release announcing the program in March. We put out our solicitation for our commercial partner in May and held a proposers day. And we're looking forward to executive summaries for proposals coming in on the 5th of July. So that's where what the history is right now. This is a flight program. It is a commercial transition. And I'll talk about what we're doing and why we're doing it. So if you go to slide number two, most of you that have been in the business for a while realize that we've been talking about space servicing for a long time. This is the idea of doing this is not a new concept, and I'll actually talk about some of the historical space servicing programs that have sort of come and gone. By the way, just to let everyone know, I'm going to talk for about 35 or 40 minutes just to leave some time for questions at the end. So on slide three, I went back and did a sort of a historical search of thinking that's gone on about satellite servicing concepts. The earliest that I found was this Lockheed picture in 1958. You know, in 1958, you could count on one finger the number of satellites at one point, and yet people were already thinking about servicing them. In the upper right-hand corner is that extremely robust-looking Marshall concept for a space servicer. In the 1980s, there was a lot of work done on the orbital maneuvering vehicle. There was a commercial venture, Orbital Recovery Corporation, in the 2000s, previous decade, and some international concepts like DLR's DEOS mission is shown in the right-hand side. None of these ever came to fruition, and I think we all basically realize why that was. People were not building their satellites to be serviced. Why weren't they doing that? Because there was no servicer. And why was there no servicer? Because people hadn't built their satellites to be serviced. So this is a paradigm that we're going to break, this chicken and egg problem, with the DARPA RSGS program. And I'll refer to it as RSGS, which is, again, Robotic Servicing of Geosynchronous Satellites. Slide four has two historical robotic servicing missions that were flown, both in LEO. The first one in 1997 was the JAXA Engineering Test Satellite 7. So there was a free flyer and a servicing vehicle, you might say, with the robotic arm. They did automated rendezvous and docking and manipulation of objects on orbit. 10 years later, the DARPA Orbital Express program flew. Did a lot of the same things that the JAXA mission did. One additional mission was the automated transfer of fluids from one spacecraft to another. Now, one thing about these two demonstrations, notice that the builders had design control over both sides of the interface. So if you wanted to use these technologies, you would have to redesign your satellite to take advantage of these modules, take advantage of the fixtures and fiducials and that sort of thing. So although these were fantastic demonstrations of automated robotics technology in orbit, the technologies were never adopted. No one ever redesigned their satellites in order to take advantage of these technologies. So going on to slide five, I mentioned that those previous demonstrations were in low Earth orbit. One of the things that we like a lot about geostationary orbit, geosynchronous orbit, is there's a lot of spacecraft there. And simply by drifting around this one ring, we can move our servicer from one customer to another. And so it sort of maximizes the number of servicing missions that you can perform. So the number of demonstrations, the number of learning opportunities we have to see how the robotics work. for those of you who don't think much about geosynchronous orbit, there are over 400 spacecraft in this orbit. About 300 of them are commercial. About 50 or 60 are U.S. government. The remainder are operated by governments of other nations. So if we structure our program properly, being in the geobelt gives us a lot of opportunities in order to visit spacecraft, to do our missions on them, and to learn from it. This is an incredibly lucrative. I mean, I bring up the old story about Willie Sutton, the bank robber. They asked him, why do you rob banks? And he said, well, that's where the money is. The 300 commercial spacecraft in geo produced revenues, in 2015, of over $110 billion. So there's a lot of money passing through this belt. There's a lot of interest. Of course, that also means there's a lot of conservatism about how the satellites are designed for extreme reliability, and a great concern about safety of flight, debris generation, and that sort of thing. So GEO is a great opportunity for us, and it's also a challenge. It also has a rather high radiation environment. It's in the outer Van Allen belt, and so spacecraft that are designed to operate for long periods of time have to be hardened against that. So it's a challenging operational environment from the radiation standpoint, also from the communication standpoint, in the sense that there are time delays associated with working in GEO. And when we talk about robotics, we'll try to explain how our program is going to deal with those time delays. So if we go on to slide six, one of the things that we plan on doing with our spacecraft is to help with deployment anomalies, to help with and other beginning of life and possibly other malfunctions that go on with spacecraft when they go up there. And this slide has two relatively recent examples of anomalies. On the left-hand side is a military satellite, the first advanced EHF satellite. It had an outage. It had a failure of its hydrazine propulsion system on the way out to GEO. So the operations team did some heroic stuff and got it to GEO using the attitude control propellant. But what that means is that at some point there may be an impact on its operations down the way. On the right-hand side, the New Dawn mission experienced a deployment failure. I believe it was an antenna deployment, but it could have been a solar panel deployment. So these kind of anomalies are sort of some of the targets of what we want to work on when we get out there. Going on to slide seven, the Naval Research Lab did a literature search of 2004 through 2014. What kind of anomalies were public? And these are all commercial. So you see one antenna deployment. I'm pretty sure that was that New Dawn spacecraft. In that 10 years, there were four solar array deployment problems, 16 propulsion problems, and then a bunch of anomalies, other categories. So just to be clear, I'm not asserting that our robotic servicer is going to be able to address every one of these, but certainly we're targeting the deployment problems and the propulsion problems as things that we can help with. Going on to slide eight, we've been doing research for the last 14 years, since 2002, to answer the question, what could a servicer do for spacecraft that weren't specially designed to be serviced? So you remember I discussed the chicken and egg problem. If people haven't redesigned their satellites for servicing, is there still anything useful that we can do? And so this is a photograph of one experiment that was looking at one possible useful thing of an unprepared spacecraft. On the left of the picture, you see a set of sensors and a bunch of wires hanging from it and two robotic arms. So think of that as the surrogate for the robotic servicer. And on the right, you see the mock-up of a spacecraft. You can see its Marmon ring, the booster attached fixture in the upper right-hand corner of the picture. And then in the far right, there's a black rectangle, and that's a simulation of a solar panel. And you'll just barely see in the right on that solar panel a little red line, that's a laser beam, that was being used to find the gap between the bus of the simulated spacecraft and that simulated solar panel. So this servicing surrogate flew itself in from several meters, found that gap, and pushed that solar panel out with no operator input. So this is a completely automated operation. It is experiments like this that we've been doing over the last 14 years that have given us confidence that we can do some useful things for unprepared spacecraft. The booster attach features are often visible, exposed, and of course they're very strong. So we look at those as docking opportunities. Another thing that we note about even unprepared spacecraft is that, I'm sorry, I already went there. All right, let's go on to the next slide. So this is the progress of the program that I'm talking about now over the last 14 years, laboratory experiments. Then there was a flight arm development program that I'll describe. Some concepts of operations and tools were developed, and these are all evolving into the current RSGS program. On slide 10, these are some pictures of those previous programs, and I'll describe some of the things that we learned in those programs. So SUMO was all laboratory demonstration, and the question was, how might we dock with an unprepared spacecraft? In this case, on the left, you see the mock-up of the zenith face of a Boeing 702 spacecraft. That's unusual because it doesn't use the Marmon ring. It uses bolts to attach it to the booster. So here you see a robotic arm that has found that bolt hole and is driving the docking fixture into it. And again, this is done from several meters into zero with no operator inputs. So that highly successful set of experiments from 2002 to 2005 led to a flight prototype arm development program, which was called FRIEND. And you see a picture here of the FRIEND arm mounted on a laboratory test fixture, and it was used in many of these experiments. So going from the sort of low-cost laboratory-grade arm that you see on the left to the actual flight prototype arm on the right, doing the same sorts of experiments, docking with bolt holes, docking with Marmon bands, doing other sorts of manipulation experiments. That flight prototype arm was also taken through all the environmental testing of a protoflight qualification program, so thermal and vacuum and shock and vibration testing, electromagnetic compatibility testing and all. So that's a well understood arm. To give you a sense of scale, that arm is about 2.3 meters end to end when it's fully extended. And interestingly, it can operate in 1G, which means that we can fly these missions just like we'd be flying them on orbit, and that gives us the ability to test software, gives you ability to test sensors with the accurate flight arm. And now, of course, there's a penalty for that, and that is that this arm is very stiff, and therefore it's very heavy. It weighs 88 kilograms. But since we're using it for docking, I think you can understand that that weight comes from the stiffness that's required in order to dock two multi-ton objects together. Down in the lower left-hand corner is a selfie. That's Orbital Express taken from its own robotic arm. There's actually a sequence of 500 such pictures that were stitched together into a pseudo video online. But Orbital Express, again, was a different sort of program because it required custom fittings, custom fiducials, custom orbital replaceable units, and that sort of thing, whereas these other programs have looked at servicing that we can provide to unprepared spacecraft. We are looking at complete cooperative operations in the restricted sense of coordinated operations. In other words, the two operations teams being in communication, the client satellite being placed in a certain passive attitude control mode and that sort of thing, but not cooperative in the sense of having special fittings and adapters and that sort of thing. In the lower right-hand corner are some tools that were developed under the Phoenix program. I'll point out a couple of them that are of particular interest. In the upper left is the the robotic end effector that was used in the Orbital Express program, we'll actually be using that in the RSGS program to capture a payload orbital delivery system, which is a detachable hosted payload concept that DARPA is working on. In the lower center of the Phoenix tools, you see something that looks like an upside-down Mickey Mouse. That is a tool changer. So on the end of our flight arms, we'll have tool changers that allow us to couple with any of the tools that you see here, as well as new tools that are developed after we're on orbit and are delivered in other ways. So this gives tremendous flexibility to this servicer. And if you look at a lot of the tools that are in that picture, they all have a common sort of a cup cone interface-like thing. We call it a common receptacle subassembly. We can actually pass power and data to tools in addition to simply mechanical force. So all these technologies are coming together into the RSGS program. And on slide 11, you see an integrated test that was done at the Naval Research Laboratory. The shiny box on the right is the surrogate for our servicer bus. There are several tools hanging on the tool fixtures on the sides. You can see the engineering development unit of the arm doing some automated robotic tool changing operations. These are actual flight controllers on the left who are sending commands just as we would send them on orbit. And in the far sort of back on the left, you can see a console that has multiple TV images. That is a console where, rather than automated operations, we would conduct teleoperations from the arm, so actually sending position commands to the arm to move it around. These integrated tests that have been being done over the last 3 or 4 years are bringing us closer to defining the concept of operations and doing all of the requirements flow down that's necessary to make sure that our operations are in sync with our design. Going on to slide 12, here is what we're trying to do with the RSGS program. There are two objectives sort of blended into one. We're going to create this dexterous robotic operational capability in GEO. And first, we're going to use it to provide resilience for the current space infrastructure by doing some having some capabilities that I'll describe, but also be the first step towards transforming the space architecture. And one of the things that's going to help us bring about that transformation is we're designing this as a long-life spacecraft. This is not like Orbital Express was. This is not a short-term 3-month demonstration. Phoenix was designed as a 1-year mission. This is being designed to DoD Class B standards, which leads to roughly a 5 to 8 year mission lifetime estimate. The other thing that I'll point out in this picture is the satellite bus, which is the sort of dark gray piece on the left. We're looking to have provided by the commercial satellite industry, and I'll explain more about why that is later. So at the end of the day, this will actually be a commercial object up in GEO, providing these services to both military and commercial spacecraft. And it'll also have the opportunity to do experiments if people want to send them up in other areas, ones that we're not baselining. For example, assembly experiments, because these robotics, especially with the tool changers, are extremely flexible and they can do a lot of different things. So we want to hopefully people will see this and they'll say, gee, what else can I do with it? We'll start getting experiments done with parts that are sent up later. They don't have to be co-launched with the robotic servicer, and start that transformation. And we'll talk a little bit later about I know that this forum, this colloquium has thought a lot about, you know, what else might we do out there. So we'll give you some of our thoughts about how this is directly applicable to some new capabilities and new missions. So going on to slide 13, this is what we call the DARPA baseline mission set. There are four capabilities here. In the upper left-hand corner, we talk about high-resolution inspection. In this case, getting our end-of-arm cameras within inches of failed mechanisms or areas that engineering data is desired from, or you know, questionable properties on the outside of the spacecraft and that sort of thing. So this is, I think, going to have a wide variety of interest. You know, there are many spacecraft that have very large deployable antennas. I think that people would be interested in just watching them deploy. And certainly if they don't deploy, this kind of inspection is the first step in figuring out what to do next. There's also a strategic importance to this. I think many people have heard discussions in the press about space being a contested environment now. If we have this ultra-close inspection capability, we may be able to resolve the difference between a natural event or an engineering flaw or some other kind of activity, possibly hostile activity, and defuse some of the concern that comes from unexpected outages of spacecraft. So I think the inspection by itself is of incredible importance. You'll note that inspection drawing, that artist's concept, has the two spacecraft docked together. Actually, all of these drawings show that. The reason for that is that time delay that I mentioned earlier. The speed of light time delay to GEO is only about a quarter of a second, but when you add network delays and encryption delays and all that sort of thing, you can get significant delays that would make teleoperation in close proximity, you know, very hazardous. By making the first step of one of these missions be a grapple with the robotic arm and then rigidizing it, you turn a dynamic situation into a static situation, increasing safety. So one of the things we've been working on for many years is to make sure that first step in the process, which is that automated grapple and docking, is highly reliable, and that's where we are. In the lower left-hand corner, the second mission in this set is what I call a relocation mission or an orbit modification mission. We have done studies that show that this can be done with a 25-pound thruster with only one arm docked. We're showing two arms grappled and docked for increased control over the center of gravity and that sort of thing. But it's actually feasible to do it with only one of these admittedly, you know, heavy, stiff arms that we have. In the upper right, the anomaly correction mission, this is a real money mission in the sense that, a spacecraft that's launched and has a deployment anomaly is going to cost its owner, or in the case of a military satellite, it's going to cost the taxpayer, a significant amount of money. The insurer can certainly pay a commercial owner-operator for the value of the spacecraft, but what they are not insured for is loss of customer base. If that satellite gets up there and people are expecting to have their TV pictures coming to them and they're not there. So the timeliness of repair, as well as the avoidance of insurance claims and that sort of thing, means that this is a very high value mission. And again, for the taxpayer, if this was a government satellite that had a failed deployment, This saved the taxpayer the cost of replacing that spacecraft, many of which are over $1 billion in cost. And then the lower right is the fourth, and I would say the newest mission set in our conceptual development, which is the ability to install packages mechanically on the outside of operating spacecraft. We have tested two ways of doing this so far. One of them is similar to a vice grip, so it's a clamp basically that we can clamp the payload to something strong like a Marmon ring, and then release it using the tool changer and leave the payload there. Now, sadly, no one's put USB ports on their satellites for us, so we can't tie into the power and data buses of that host spacecraft. So the payloads that we attach in the near term will have to be self-powered and self-communicating. So here you see this little payload. That's the little white box there with its own solar panel and its own radio. It could be that if this catches on, so to speak, people will start putting connectors onto their spacecraft that allow these upgrade payloads to be integrated with, or to take advantage of the power and the communications of that host bus. So these are the four things that we've developed our requirements around, the four capabilities that are supported by the hardware that we've done, by the software work that we've developed algorithms in order to do all these things, and are confident that we can execute. And once again, the foot stomper is none of these host spacecraft were modified in any way for servicing. These are things that we could do as soon as we get on orbit. So going on to slide 14, I mentioned that we have an approach for getting material to GEO and interacting with the robotic servicer. Many of you may have heard about the concept of the hosted payload. So a hosted payload is something that's placed on a commercial geostationary satellite integrated with its power and communication and that sort of thing. What you're seeing on slide 14 is a hosted payload that is detachable. It's on and it's called the Payload Orbital Delivery System, or PODS. The two components on the right, the lower component is really just a bunch of springs, and the upper component is a strong back and then some hardware mounted on the strong back. And this the strong back is ejected out into orbit near GEO, possibly in the GEO plus or GEO minus region. When the robotic servicer is nearby, and you notice on the bottom of that strong back, there's a little ball and stick. That is the mating end for the capture tool that I showed earlier that was tested out in the Orbital Express program. So the robot will come along and grab this pallet after it's been ejected from the original host. And then it can transport the pallet to another spacecraft or a set of other spacecraft, possibly unpack the strong back and take these payloads and install them on other spacecraft. So now we're actually talking about a synergy between this capability and the robotic servicer itself. If you go to slide 15, I call it a space logistics infrastructure, or a geo-logistics infrastructure. So on the left-hand side, you can see two sort of arcs here. The pods could be used to deliver things to near GEO, and the servicer captures those released payloads, brings them to spacecraft, and installs things on them. In the future, it's possible that newly designed satellites will have expendable payloads in them, whether they're inspection spacecraft or defensive techniques or whatever. Those might need to be replenished, and so this robotic servicer could also have the capability of doing that replenishment. In the upper left-hand corner in green, you see the servicer being used for the space tug mission, where there's a maneuver, then the servicing vehicle docks with that customer spacecraft and takes it to a new orbit, whether it's the original orbit after a maneuver or whether it's to a new slot in GEO or to the graveyard. And this infrastructure comes into existence as soon as the robotic servicer is on orbit. So that would be late 2020 or early 2021 if I didn't say that. The pods, that capability is being developed not within my program itself, but by one of my colleagues here at DARPA. That'll have its first flight test next year in 2017. Space Systems Loral is the company that's doing the current work under DARPA funding to bring that PODS capability about. Now, I should point out that PODS capability is also just a great way of getting things out of low Earth orbit and into a higher orbit. You could have a PODS flight that was a free flyer that had its own propulsion, attitude control, communications, and whatever, just to be a satellite, or it can be used, as I've shown here, in conjunction with the servicing vehicle in order to bring new capabilities up. Some of the things we like about that idea, and I'll talk now from sort of the DOD standpoint. One of the issues you have when you're flying capabilities to space, I mean, it's great that people are making their satellites last a long time. However, that sort of that begs the question about obsolescence, right? So what this capability gives us is potentially the ability to either bring whole new capabilities up or to replace them, to upgrade them on a much more frequent cycle life than when we're building whole new classes of satellites, because those tend to drift into obsolescence over their lifetime. Same thing is actually true on the commercial side. Just as one example, antennas on commercial communication satellites are often very, very carefully shaped in order to match a customer base that on the Earth. Well, what if that customer base changes a few years into the life of that spacecraft? You may have a spacecraft that you paid for 15 years of life, and it's really only useful for 5. So the ability to do these on-orbit upgrades is equally, I think, valuable to both the military side and the commercial side. Going on to slide 16, now these are the sorts of things that I'm sure have been discussed before at FISO colloquia. And these are all NASA images, by the way. In the upper left-hand side is a sort of concept for automated refueling, where now you have a customer satellite that has been outfitted with special docking fiducials and coupling and fixtures and refueling fixtures, quick disconnects and that sort of thing, so that the docking can happen almost automatically without anyone, you know, really even noticing, that sort of thing. In the lower left is a picture of the assembly of a conceptual design for a very large optical telescope. And that's a captive robot. That's not a free flyer there. In the upper right-hand corner, you have a conceptual drawing of a low Earth orbit to geospace tug. And I will say that from the commercial point of view, that is a real money saver if such a tug existed, because the cost to get these commercial communication satellites out to GEO is, you know, two-thirds of the mass is used up to just get them from LEO to GEO. If that could be done another way, you wouldn't have to have that upper stage that gets it out there. People are very excited about this concept. And it's obvious that robotics, the kind of robotics that we're going to highlight and place on orbit in the RSGS program, robotics in general are really central to all of these more advanced capabilities. I don't have a picture on here, but I'll also mention the idea of on-orbit assembly of interplanetary stacks. I imagine most people on the call saw The Martian. There was a very large vehicle in that movie that went back and forth from Earth orbit to Martian orbit. I think it was called Hermes. That was so large, it was clearly not delivered in a single launch. And so it was assembled, you know, at some point. I would argue that assembling things like that with robots is probably going to be less expensive and certainly less risky than assembling with astronauts, although we know that given the International Space Station, that astronauts are certainly capable of assembling things, but there is a certain cost to that. So our view is that we get our servicing vehicle on orbit, and some of these other capabilities will start to be developed as a result. In addition to providing that capability, that resiliency, that reliability enhancement to the current fleet of spacecraft that are up there and those that are launched near term. So now we'll talk about how we're going to execute this program. Slide 17, we're looking for a commercial partner team coming from U.S. industry. And that team consists of really three entities, the builder. And the builder is going to bring that satellite bus that we'll integrate the government-developed robotics onto. Obviously, we're looking for, you know, people with a lot of heritage in building geosatellites and that sort of thing. A second entity that we have to identify in our partner is the owner. What is the actual entity that will own the spacecraft when it's in orbit? So that owner is required to handle the liability. So they have to obtain insurance. They have to, give certification of proper operation and that sort of thing to whatever regulators there are. But, of course, it's also the owner that gets the revenue from these servicing operations, so that gets the fees that are paid by people that need their spacecraft to be serviced. And then the operator I suppose is self-evident what that is, but that includes the ground network of ground terminals and the operations center and that sort of thing, and most importantly, the operations team that we and the Naval Research Lab will help to train at the beginning in the operation of these fairly complex robotic payloads. But that team will join with us as we develop the payload and then put this all together and instantiate that geoservicing capability. So this is an unusual program approach, but we think that it's an important one it's an important direction to go because it gives us easier access to those 300 commercial satellites that are in GEO. If we have this commercial team, it's more likely that they'll be able to get a lot of servicing of the commercial birds rather than this being an all-government program. And here are some of the things that we do hope are going to flow out of the program, the capability once it's up there. We've already discussed space logistics. New services and architectures will require some redesign. The POS capability could be used to send up experiments. So people have talked for a long time about building things on orbit. I'm not sure that's trivial, and it's this could be considered a laboratory on orbit for the use of robotics in assembling structures, apertures, bases, antenna, modular spacecraft, and that sort of thing. And upgrades is a capability that we did demonstrate on Orbital Express. So there was a modularized processor that was removed from the surrogate customer satellite, and a new processor was installed in that same slot, and it picked up the processing load. So we have a proof of principle on orbit that spacecraft can be upgraded after they're on orbit, and we hope that by putting this capability out there, people will start to design their spacecraft in order to take advantage of it. So going on to slide 19, this partnership is unusual. We understand that, and we think it's absolutely the right way to go for a number of reasons. We'll be bringing, as the government, the robotic payload. We'll be providing a launch. And we're going to give a small payment to our partner once they complete an on-orbit demonstration. So, in a sense, we'll be their first customer. And we're looking for the partner team to design the bus that has heritage from lines of spacecraft that they've built in GEO. Although it's clear that there is no spacecraft, you know, sitting on the shelf that's already ready to do this, that there have to be modifications to the control software, to the attitude control system, and that sort of thing, to allow it to do rendezvous and proximity operation. The partner will be the lead for the integration of the robotics onto the bus, and they will provide, we're asking them to provide the ground segment. So as I mentioned, this approach gives us access to more customers than it would if it was a strictly military spacecraft, which means more opportunities to learn. What are the limitations of these robotic systems, especially in geostationary orbit? We think we're helping to close the business case by bringing these years of development in robotic systems to our commercial partner, and we're hoping for favorable terms for the relatively infrequent cases where government spacecraft might need to be serviced. The vehicle that we're using is something that's ensconced in U.S. law. It's called the Other Transactions for Prototype. It's actually part of the United States Code. But what it means is that we will be in a true partnership. This will not be the government dictating to our commercial team everything they're going to do. We'll make decisions together. We'll jointly work for the growth of the satellite servicing industry. We're looking for our partner to actually propose what the management structure is. It's not being dictated in advance, and that will include a real collaborative decision-making. This won't be easy. We recognize that. But this is the best way we could think of to get this capability out there and do everything that we wanted to do. As I said, this partner team has been solicited, so that went out in mid-May, a 66-page program solicitation. I will say that we learned a lot of lessons from NASA's COTS program, so there are a lot of similarities to the COTS program in the way we solicited this partner team. But a big difference is that COTS was mainly a transfer of funds from the U.S. government to two teams to build launch vehicles. We're not transferring a lot of funds. We're transferring technology. So that's really the big discriminator between the COTS program and the RSGS program. After the servicer has been launched and is on orbit late 2020, early 2021, we will have arranged for one or more vehicles that are out there, whether these are military vehicles or commercial vehicles is yet to be determined, to be the first customers, to be the places where we do close inspection, docking, and some force application with the ends of the arms that are representative of the kind of forces we would apply in a repair kind of scenario if we don't happen to be able to find a customer that has a deployment anomaly that we can actually correct. Check-in and calibration phase, as always, inspection, tugging, anomaly resolution, upgrade. We may bring a box with us that is itself a functional upgrade capability, or perhaps it's just an empty box, but to show the viability of that whole concept. Probably 6 to 9 month on orbit demonstration period. And then the partner is free to conduct these servicing operations for fee, both from the commercial satellite industry and GEO and for the government. So again, and we recognize that several years of operation will be required for the partner to make back their investment in that bus that they brought. So we are designing with a very high standard for a nominal 5 to 8 year mission life of the payload. Now, another thing, of course, as you recognize, that will limit the life of the spacecraft is the propellant that it consumes. And it'll be up to our partner to propose, you know, is it going to be chemical? Is it going to be electric propulsion? How much propellant are they going to bring? But that's another factor in how long the spacecraft will operate and how much total revenue that it can generate before reaching end of life. So going on to slide 21, this is our schedule. Our partner selection process is going to be kind of protracted. Part of the reason for that is to allow that teaming to occur. I mentioned that there's a builder and an owner and an operator. They have to kind of find each other and work out how they're going to finance the project and how they're going to work together. So we're giving them a lot of time to do that. We expect to have the bus and payloads done separately in 2018, integrated in 2019, and then the pre-launch testing basically most of 2020, with a launch in late 2020 to early 2021, followed by that 6 to 9 month capability demonstration. So that is the DARPA RSGS program. There are a lot of details that I obviously couldn't cover in this period of time, but I will now be happy to answer any of your questions. Thank you.
Great. Gordon, thank you so much. I've got a question to kick off the questioning as part of, all very interesting. As part of your, presumably you all yourselves have looked at, as you described, the business case for it. So you knew that your solicitation was not crazy and that it would be plausibly attractive to potential partners. As part of the, and I'm asking this question for a colleague here, who I don't know if he joined us.
Who wishes to remain anonymous?
No, usually he almost always dials in. But I didn't hear him, and I did want to ask his question. And that is, as part of the looking at the if there is a plausible business case, did you compare that with, instead of on-orbit servicing and refueling, whatever, with just simple replacement of the target spacecraft?
Yeah, absolutely. Of course, one of the things that happens with simple replacement is there's a loss of time in there. So in the case of the commercial operator, that replacement time puts our customer base in jeopardy. In the case of the military, it means that the warfighter on the ground isn't getting the benefit of those, communications or warning services or whatever. And from the tug operator's point of view, from the servicer operator's point of view, we did a fairly comprehensive analysis of the revenues, along with probabilities of reaching contract or not reaching contract, and what the final fee was going to be, and that sort of thing. And it looks to us like the servicer owner can recoup their investment in between 3 and 7 years. And we actually published this, and it was in a paper at Space 2015. So that study is out there and available for people to look at. And different people have different views on exactly how much revenue and exactly what is the probability of getting to yes in the negotiation and that sort of thing. But we think this is far, far superior to replacement. And the more expensive the customer spacecraft is, the more obvious that is, right?
Got it. Do other folks have questions?
Yeah, Gordon, this is Dan Lester right here. I just had a quick question. This is really great stuff. Thank you very much for giving this talk, and it's very exciting. I wanted to ask you about the long-term role of DARPA in this partnership. That is, you got a 5 to 8 year operational payload. Is DARPA going into the business of satellite repair with partners, or is your vision that the capability will eventually be commercialized, I guess, handing it all off to your builder or operator? How is this going to work in the long run?
Very good question. So we basically fall off the radar screen after that government-organized capability demonstration is done.
Okay.
Our relationship with the owner of the robotic servicer is done as of the end of that demonstration.
Okay, and so basically what you bring is that you supply the dexterous capability to the spacecraft that the builder builds. Is that right? And then you turn.
Absolutely right. Now,
okay.
There will be companies that wanted to partner with us, but we'll probably only be able to fund one. We will find ways to transfer this technology to the other interested U.S. Aerospace companies as well. We've always been very clear that this wasn't, we didn't intend for this to wind up in the hands of a single company, but that company will obviously have an advantage because they'll have it earlier and they'll be there for the integration and they'll be the first ones to operate it. But the software is unique, the robotics, the tools, the integrated concept of operations is unique, and so we're going to find ways to transfer that to every interested part of the U.S. aerospace industry.
Okay, that's great. Thank you.
Gordon, this is Greg Potner at Boeing. You talked about on-orbit assembly of large things like large spacecraft. My understanding is on-orbit assembly of things like the satellites would allow much easier lift of smaller components that don't have to be hardened for lift then. They can be assembled on orbit. And then if you're doing assembly on orbit, it's sort of natural due to repair on orbit because it's already designed for it.
I completely agree. There's a sort of architecture we have in mind for doing that, where there's some sort of a, you might call it a factory in LEO, where components of spacecraft, perhaps modules or subassemblies of spacecraft, are sent up maybe by some of these smaller launch vehicles that people are working on now, and then there's this factory where they're put together. I think to make that architecture make sense, you need a service or something like we have here in order to catch the payloads when they come up, because you don't want to have to put Rendezvous and ProxOps hardware and software on every payload that you send up, because that really drives the cost up. Instead, I think if you have something like this to grab them and bring them over to the factory, and then, of course, you want a tug, which may be the same spacecraft, but it's probably different, to take the integrated spacecraft from the factory to some other orbit, whether it's GEO or polar or wherever you want it to
right.
go.
Right. Yeah, no, this is wonderful because the manufacturing infrastructure, you need these different kinds of functions. So I'm wondering if you're, well, maybe you can't answer, if you're currently working with Boeing, or can I have an off off-the-side conversation with you at some point soon.
Yeah, absolutely. Give me a call, send me an email, gordon.ressler@dark.mil. There's really not it's actually one of my colleagues, Dr. Jeremy Palmer, is leading the charge here at DARPA on in-space assembly and manufacturing, but we can hook you up and you can have figure out what we are doing.
Thank you.
Other questions? Do folks have other questions for Gordon?
Yeah. Who asked that last question? This is Dallas, Harley.
This is Greg Potter.
Yeah.
Okay. Greg.
Greg Potter.
P-O-D-N-A-R. N-A-R? Okay.
Thanks. With whom?
Boeing.
Okay. Boeing.
Thank you.
Research and technology.
All right. This is Dallas at Boeing, so just trying to make connections. Caught us by surprise.
Big place.
Let's join up, Dallas. Thank you.
Will do.
Hey, Gordon, it's Dave Huntsman.
Hi, Dave.
Hey, one question I had is, you know, one of the reasons COTS ended up being successful was that NASA, at about the same time or shortly after COTS was initiated, in the presence of Mike Griffin, got up and made a public policy pronouncement that said it was NASA's intention, once stuff was developed, that we would no longer purchase cargo services in the case of COTS and CRS from any government entity anymore, that we shall use commercial services, so that you had that stake in the ground for anybody looking to invest to be able to count on. It's trickier in your case, but is there any long-term thought given to, after the demo mission is hopefully successful, that the DOD or maybe DOD and NASA through OSTP or somebody actually make a policy pronouncement saying, okay, whenever servicing is needed on orbit, we're going to first look to commercial industry. We won't develop a competing government-owned system to do it, something that actually gives the investment community a warm fuzzy that they won't go into this and then have their legs cut out from under them.
Well, I don't know of anything going quite in that direction, but I think it's pretty clear that this capability is very unique. It will be commercial. I also failed to mention the work that's going on that we're certainly collaborating with at Goddard Space Flight Center in on-orbit refueling. You'll notice, I mean, if you went back to slide 13, you'd notice that refueling is not in the DARPA baseline mission set. So NASA Goddard has been doing the robotic refueling missions on station to prove that an unprepared spacecraft can be refueled by pulling off insulation blankets, cutting the lock wires, unscrewing the caps, and refueling that way. I believe that Goddard also intends to make that capability eventually available to industry as well. But I think what the investors are interested in my case is, are there going to be government customers for this? And I will say that there's a large number of government entities that are looking at how can I use these capabilities. You know, there's concern about the vulnerability of a U.S. military spacecraft, so there are some thoughts on how we can put payloads on them to make them less vulnerable, and just to get situational awareness and space weather data. There are, the possibility of putting upgrades on spacecraft for backup capabilities for sensors that are, or communication systems that are on other spacecraft. So just sort of scattering them around the geobelt, putting more of them, perhaps of lower capability but more proliferated and that sort of thing. So there are a lot of studies and analyses going on about how might, but they're just beginning, about how might this capability be used. And those would represent government clients for the servicer and for future servicers. I mean, this is just a prototype, right? We're hoping that the utility of this leads to, a continuing supply of these things going out to at least a GEO to do a wide variety of these missions.
Okay.
Good. Other questions for Gordon?
This is Chuck Lilly. Just wanted to ask if you had considered looking at the ground test connection plug for on spacecraft for getting into their electronics and computers. In other words, actually talking to them.
That kind of falls from me, from my narrow standpoint in this program. That kind of falls into the same category as the refueling. I am not intending to do high dexterity operations on blankets and nuts and bolts and that sort of thing. That's kind of not where we were. Our baseline mission set doesn't go there. We've certainly thought about it, and I think others have as well. If we learn that, no, that's not as hard as you think it is, and that sort of thing, it's possible that tools could be developed that would enable doing that. What we're really hoping is that people start putting on their spacecraft the equivalent of a USB port, basically, so that payload comes up, it can be plugged in. We don't think that's that large an impact on most spacecraft that are developed, and hopefully they'd be motivated to do that. Is that okay, Chuck?
Yeah, that answers my question. Thank you.
You're welcome.
This is Al Tadros. I had a question if there's still time left.
Sure, go ahead. So far as Gordon's schedule permits.
I'm fine.
Great. Great talk, Gordon. Again, this is Al Tadros at SSL. I just wanted to see if you can say a few words about kind of the regulatory and not so much for the demonstration phase, but going forward and the role that DARPA would have on regulation and standards, licensing, code of conduct, et cetera.
You know, thank you for asking that question. That was something that I didn't get a chance to address in the talk. DARPA recognizes that there are policy concerns and potential emergence of regulations, for example, in this whole space traffic management business that might affect on-orbit servicing and other advanced operations in space. So what DARPA has decided to do is to organize and facilitate, not lead necessarily, but facilitate a government industry consortium to look at those questions, to try to develop voluntary industry standards. And often when you think of standards, you think of mechanical standards, you know, like connectors and that sort of thing. What we're really talking about here is operational and safety standards, and also get consensus on how policy should develop. And it'll be my colleague, Mr. Todd Master, is another program manager here at DARPA who is leading that effort. And he's being very forward-leaning and pulling people together and getting teams together to start tackling that question. There are some other industries where essentially all of the safety regulation and inspection and that sort of thing is done by the industry, even though there's a government regulator in existence. The nuclear industry and the electric grids in the United States, all of the safety standards are developed by commercial entities. So we're thinking of that as a possible and a help, actually, to any government regulator that comes into being, because I think this area is so technical, it would be very difficult to develop these operational standards in a vacuum. So we thank you for asking the question, because that's really important that people know that we haven't ignored the fact that there are some policy vacuums that are going to get filled, and we want to make sure they've got the right people working to answer them.
Okay, again, other questions? Other questions for Gordon? All right, Gordon, thank you again. Excellent presentation, as expected. So, terrific, folks. Talk to you all next Wednesday.
Thank you for having me.